Welcome back to Supreme Myths. I'm very excited today to have on my podcast Professor Robert Tsai from Boston University. Robert is a graduate of UCLA and Yale. He has written too many articles to mention. He has written four books, or he's about to come out with his fourth book, this most recent one being Demand the Impossible, One Lawyer's Pursuit of Equal Justice for All. It's a book about the death penalty and Stephen Bright, a person who was at one time somewhat associated with my law school, but who is a great fighter of the death penalty. This is a wonderful book. I pre-order it. It's coming out soon. Robert has been writing articles in places like The New Yorker and Slate and The Boston Globe, and he is quite simply one of our most important and prominent constitutional law professors in the United States. Robert, it's great to have you.
Eric, it's great to be with you, and thanks for such a generous introduction.
Well, I'm a big fan, and I read your work all the time. So let's begin with this new book, Demand the Impossible. How did you get interested in the death penalty, Stephen Bright, and writing this book?
Yeah, great questions. Let me try to answer your question in sort of several registers. I mean, at the personal level, I can think of my high school days as the first moment that I, you know, even thought seriously about the issue. I was asked in high school to debate the death penalty, and so was forced to do a little bit of research in there, and came across things like, of course, Ronald Reagan's defense of why he was a supporter of capital punishment, and various things like that. And then I think when I got to college, I remember taking a class in the political science department at UCLA, taught by a guy who was incredibly pro-death penalty.
Okay.
And I will say that sort of clarity, though, in the professor really forced me to think hard about my own views. And in his final assignment was to go and find some actual death penalty cases and in the paper to recount the facts of what happened and then talk about whether, you know, you think that what the fact that they got the death sentence was defensible. So I decided that I was going to abide by the professor's rules, but I was also going to find some cases where there were some reasons to wonder about what happened. And so I remember picking several cases. One was, you know, someone that nobody ever heard of, but there were some procedural justice questions. Then I picked the one about, you know, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, the guy that was... Right. And there were some questions about innocence and so forth. And then, of course,
Robert, hold on 1 second. for the demographic that listens to this, many will know that reference, but many will not, sadly. In the 1920s, Charles Lindbergh was one of the most famous Americans ever. He flew across the ocean or something. And famously, his baby was kidnapped. And it was a big, huge story. And that's what Robert's referring to.
There were people here huge story. And, you know, I don't remember all the details, but I remember the theory of the prosecution's case was something like, someone like found out that the kid was like on the second or third floor of this house and somehow got a ladder or something. There's a lot of funny questions about what happened. But in any event, I picked a bunch of things that raised issues so I could push back. Because I sort of felt like the assignment was jerry-rigged a little bit to come to a conclusion that the professor wanted.
Right.
But ultimately, he gave me an A, and so I felt like he had some you know, intellectual integrity in that. So, so that's one level. That's the personal answer to your question. So I've always been sort of interested. But in terms of Steve Bright, you know, when I was in law school, I was supposed to take his class. I can't remember if I've told Steve Bright this since then, but, and I was really gung ho about it. And you had to write a little essay about why you want to take the class. And then he would decide, you know, whether people really were interested.
Excuse me, Robert. I'm sorry to interrupt. Just for people who don't know, Steve Bright taught at both Harvard and Yale for a very long period of time. He was never officially associated with those schools in terms of tenure, but he's taught there all the time. Go ahead.
That's right. He started teaching at Yale Law School. I think that's the first law school he taught at. And I mean, that year, like, you know, the students loved him so much. I think they asked him to give the commencement speech, and then they just couldn't get rid of him, you know. So even though he didn't write enough to be, you know, tenurable at Yale Law School, they kept finding ways to keep him around through various visitorships and so forth. You know, and since then, of course, he's taught elsewhere. But so, you know, I was there when he, I think, had taught either 1 or 2 years. And I was excited about getting into his class. And at the last minute, I ended up taking something else. I've taken Bruce Ackerman's class or something. But had I not done that, I probably wouldn't have been in a position to write a book about right now in academia. But in any event, I always kept one eye on him, was interested in what made a person like that tick, to be such
when
a
you
crusader.
Say when you say a person like that, describe what you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so... you know, what's interesting about Bright, you know, really is a lot of things. I mean, from the perspective of a sort of social activist, which he has been since his youth, at least since his college years, you know, he's seen everything from student resistance to the Vietnam War to being a legal aid lawyer, where he was first trained in Kentucky, and then a public defender in, you know, kind of the mean streets of Washington, D.C., before he then assumes the leadership of this organization called the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta for the next, you know, 35 years. So he's really done a lot. And I, you know, I only knew kind of the surface part of it, which was, you know, here's this guy who's at Yale, seems really committed to the cause. I'm interested in learning about what causes someone to be so committed, and what can we as a society learn from people you know, like that are so committed to a cause. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what drew me to him, and of course I never took a class with him, so then he's, you know, kind of always been at the periphery. My wife actually went to work for him. A few years later, she got a fellowship to work with children who were incarcerated in Georgia, and then went down to the Southern Center and worked for him. So I kind of got to know Steve a little bit better through her. But I can't say we, you know, stayed in touch at all, you know, and I really didn't have any contact with him once I got into academia. But I will say this, that once I saw that Brian Stevenson's book, you know, was received as such acclaim, and then of course they made a movie about it,
right?
I started to wonder a couple of things. First of all, I mean, the thing about the capital punishment is it's been with us for a long time, but not a lot of people like to publish books or articles about it. And if you write about the subject, you know, you'll get a lot of editors in prominent places say, like, do we really need to talk about this? You know, why don't we talk about something else in the news at the moment? I'll be honest. I've talked to editors, and they'll be like, well, why don't we wait until the next execution, sort of a grisly thing, so that it's in people's minds. Otherwise they don't want to talk about, you know, so, right. You know, but I will say that I was hopeful that when, you know, Brian's book and movie was received as such acclaim, that perhaps people were interested in, thinking a little harder about it, you know, wonder also whether people were curious as to the guy who gave Brian Stevenson his first job out of law school. You know, because when you flip to the beginning of Just Mercy, I don't know if you've looked at it, but
Robert, we require it. We have our first year students read it before they ever get here.
Do you really? Well, maybe you need to require this one.
We might in the future.
Or further reading, you know,
yes.
Because at the beginning of Just Mercy, Brian Stevenson talks about meeting Steve Bright for the first time. It says, like, this is the first guy I've ever met in my life who was committed to the idea of equal justice, you know, and lived it every day. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what Stevenson conveys.
And let me just say, you're not the only, I mean, I want the audience to understand that you are by far not the only person in awe of this man. Almost every law professor in Atlanta, where his organization is, you know, is in awe of him. I know him. I've heard him speak on numerous occasions. And one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to you and read your book is he is a fascinating figure. And he also is one of the best speakers I've ever seen. I've been listening to speakers for 33 years, some really great ones. He's top three or four. I mean, he's just amazing. So if nothing else, I want to whet people's appetite for this book. This is a man who is special. You meet him and you know right away, this is someone who's not your average bear, who's not your average, not even your average social activist. What do you think made him that way? What in his upbringing or his DNA or both, or do you have a theory as to what made him so special and so committed?
I do. I try to answer this, I think I got to the essence of it, and I don't want to give away all the details, but
Sure.
I think the for people who have been in the public eye for as long as he has, and you're absolutely right that if you've had any contact with Steve Bright, it's probably because you heard an inspirational speech and went, "My God,
Yes.
that
Yes.
guy can
I thought
bring
I was
people
pretty
to
good. I thought I was pretty good, but I suck
their
compared
feet."
to
No, I mean,
him.
there's like, there's a little bit of a there's a little bit of a biblical aspect, people have said, to the kind of way he gives rousing speeches. There's a kind of call to action. There's a moral cause here, and it requires a certain amount of sacrifice. Maybe you're the kind of person that's willing to sort of also care about equal justice that's being, it's being denied in places in the Deep South and elsewhere. So, when you've been in the public eye as long as he has, you also start to tell a kind of a stock story about yourself. And I think, he has done that, which is not to say that it's a lie. It's not, but it's highly simplified. And I wanted to puncture that a little bit, so that people who have met him and even people who have known him well will hopefully learn something new. So I was pleased that when Brian Stevenson got a look at the book, he was able to say like, "Oh, I actually did learn a few things about, about Steve." One of the things he does talk about, which I did investigate, was he talks about his sort of student activism years, but he doesn't really tell a lot about those days. And I was able to
Well,
delve into
Robert, I don't think he likes talking about himself. Is that fair?
that's the other thing. Absolutely. He's almost like Batman, in that sense. He's like the personification of a cause, and there's not a lot of time to be, introspective. There are, lives to be saved.
It's funny you say that. It's really funny you say that about Batman, because given that he teaches at a number of different elite law schools and some non-elite law schools, given he does come in and out of the world a little bit like Batman. Now that you mention it, he does. He doesn't really have a home. I mean, he has a home, but I mean, he's everywhere all at once. That's a great analogy.
The only thing he
You
doesn't
know,
have is he doesn't have an origin story,
right?
like a
Well, that's
true
what I was going to
origin.
ask you. Is there so your radicalization about the death penalty, I suspect, kind of came, as you described with that teacher and the more you learned and all of that. From reading your book, I don't know if there was like I don't think we can find a moment in time that turned him. I think he just was always like this. Is that fair?
Well, I would say two th I would give the answer in two ways. There's the question of how does he become a kind of advocate, and how does he become kind of open to social activism, and then how does he become open to kind of committing his life against the death penalty and equal justice? Because I think that becomes a much more specific thing down the road. But as to the first question, I think the answer lies in what I detect is that he from a very young age, was a political animal. Because the shocking thing is when I asked him, like, "Man, the way you speak and the way you are able to take other people's arguments apart, like you must have done debate, like in college." And he's like, "Nope, never did." So he was kind of self-taught, in terms of being an orator and a speaker. And I think that the answer is this: is that he's always been interested in politics since he was a young person. And I won't give all the details, but I will say it's worth focusing on the early parts of the book and the preface in particular, where when I think back on the interviews he's given me and he's really opened up, he is extremely wistful about having met these great political speakers that came through Kentucky. At a time when there were the occasional sort of progressive politicians in Kentucky. And I think that had a huge impact, although he doesn't talk about it as part of his, public stock story about himself.
But go
And I,
ahead.
so I think that's the beginning
Right.
of
What I was
Steve
going to say
Bright.
was, and this is a little bit inside baseball, so I apologize to those who don't follow the inside baseball I'm about to mention, but he reminds me, I know, There's a lawyer in Atlanta named Emmett Bondurant, And Emmett has been representing Common Cause forever. And I helped Emmett with a case involving John Lewis and the filibuster. Emmett argued a voting rights case in the Supreme Court in 1963. And he argued Rucho in 2019, which is an amazing thing if one thinks about it. What I was going to say was, Emmett is a corporate lawyer for his own law firm, or was before he retired, but Emmett had a sense of social justice in him. That's why he's Common Cause as lawyer from the very beginning. And he's a very excellent oral arguer at the appellate level. And he and Steve, I think both, you know, they share kind of same age, common age, common beginnings. Steve's a little bit younger, but they're very similar. And Atlanta has produced two of these people who I think are really, I mean, again, Wright's from Kentucky, but he spent most of his career here. I'm very proud of both of these people. They are both incredible. I want to say this carefully. They are incredible Southerners who have worked really hard to try to make a dent in the South's egregious racist past by doing things in the present. And I have so much respect for both of them in that sense. I don't know if you know Emmett, but they actually remind me of each other a little bit.
Yeah, I haven't had the pleasure of actually speaking with them, but I will say even in the late 90s, early 2000s, yeah. When I was in Atlanta, the Emmett Bondurant and the Bondurant firm was always fairly active as cooperating attorneys in a whole bunch of causes, including. Active on with the ACLU. So one of the lawyers, I think in his firm, Jill, wasn't Jill Pryor in his firm. So I worked with Jill and the then legal director of the ACLU on a case. And Jill did the cert petition on the case where a bunch of school kids were strip searched in a high school. And
I remember that. Yes.
You remember that? Okay. It's been a while.
And she's now a federal judge. Anyway, all right, going back to Stephen Bright.
Of course.
So you in your book, and I want to get back to your book because we do have other things to talk about. So getting back to your book. So the book tells the story of this man and his fight against injustice and the death penalty. And the book is told through other than the preface and a few other chapters, through stories of actual cases. Can you pick one of the most compelling cases and just tell the audience why you picked that case and why it's important to tell this story?
Sure. I think all four are important. Generally for this reason, which is because we're able to see the way that that race permeates the criminal justice system in various ways, but in particular how underrepresented juries are. So at the beginning of Bright's time in the Deep South doing capital work. He and others are sort of just throwing arguments like spaghetti against the wall, trying to save people. That's one metaphor. The other one that Steve offered me is like he felt like a medic, kind of running from person to person on a battlefield.
Right.
And they don't know what's working, but eventually, I argue that they settle onto a smaller set of sort of pragmatic arguments about the enforcement of capital punishment. Notably, one of the things that Bright kind of hammers everywhere he goes, which is the quality of representation, which is so poor in these kinds of cases. And there's a lot of structural problems. If you want to go into, we can talk about those. But these four cases illustrate the structural things like that poor people get inadequate, and it's shockingly bad in some of these cases. You read the facts and they make you want to cry because, you know. You've got lawyers who, you know, so despise their own clients that they won't even make an opening argument. They won't make a closing argument to, beg for their client's life. They will put on no mitigating evidence to help the jury, hang on to something for why this person's life is worth saving. These are the kinds of things that would make you cry as a human being or as a lawyer that someone could do so little work. But each of these four cases showcases certain structural things like that, but then there are other things that are in some cases and not others, like manipulation of the number of Black people on juries, and that's a complicated thing because that's a complicated process when one thinks about how juries are selected, right? So I won't go into all the cases, but one thing that two of the cases kind of focuses in on is, you know, once you've got the jury pools created, and, you know, individual citizens are being called in and questioned for possible service in a, let's say, a criminal case, then traditionally, right, each side has a number of peremptory strikes, as you, as I know you know, which means that traditionally the prosecutor and then, of course, the defense side can eliminate X number of jurors without giving any reason at all. And, you know, so this has been a huge loophole, right, by tradition, where if you wanted to manufacture an all-white jury, and, you know, there are a bunch of empirical reasons why, if you're super committed to the death penalty on the prosecutorial side, having a mostly male and preferably all-white jury is going to increase the odds of getting to a death sentence. And especially if it's an African-American on trial.
Right? And especially if there's a white victim, but that's a different conversation.
And especially if there's a white victim, precisely. So, now we know, like, the let's call it the structural pressures on the prosecutor, even the, you know, one who might be acting in good faith to prosecute crime, to cut corners and try to get to white, all white juries and so forth. But so, you know, at least two of the cases, we can go into one of them, a little further, showcase the this sort of second or third stage problem, which is peremptory strikes.
And that's, and Rob, let's back up for 1 minute, because there are some law students and non-lawyers listening to this, which is, it's very surprising to me, but there are. The Supreme Court issued a decision in the Batson case that said if you intend to strike people because of their color, and of course this is always white prosecutors, or prosecutors, you know, striking black jurors. If you do that enough times or in a certain way and there's evidence for it, then that is unconstitutional. And some of the cases in your book raise that issue. And boy, I mean, it's just so obvious what they're doing, and yet judges close their eyes.
Absolutely. So, you know, the Batson case is the most famous case, which finally said for the first time, you know, if a single juror, prospective juror, is removed through a peremptory strike on the basis of his or her race, then that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. What's interesting is most people forget about the case that that sort of overruled, and it's a case called Swain versus Alabama. There's a huge irony about that case because. The way before Batson that one could even make out a claim in this way was to show in a structural way, right, that say a prosecutor's office had over time, like, repeatedly done this, and the pattern had to be really strong. So I say ironic because you know, the court was aware of things like structural problems. But also, they said that's the only kind of violation we would even recognize. So it was incredibly difficult. And if you look in the 11th Circuit, I think there was like one time in each state under Swain that the 11th Circuit had ever found a Swain violation or something. One of those ends up being one of Bright's cases that I talk about, just a case called Horton versus Zant. And you know, that doesn't happen until the 90s, and they're still having to deal with Swain. But in any event. So Batson makes things better, as you suggest. But, you know, Batson still is not easy to satisfy, because, you know, just imagine what it's like picking a jury. It's super pressure filled. A lot of people are coming through the room. There's a lot of things to think about. And the first time a person of color is removed by, say, a prosecutor, you know, if you're defense counsel, you might not object right then and there. And this, we see this over and over, and in some of these cases that Bright ends up arguing, because in theory, the moment someone objects, then the prosecutor is supposed to give a non-racial reason for why they remove the person, and then the judge is supposed to make a finding. But imagine how often the judge is going to say, you know, the prosecutor just eliminated someone on the basis of race.
The first time
they do it.
Right. And on that point, Robert, I want the audience to really understand. I spent the last 40 years of my life in the South, so I'm quite familiar with the terrain here. I want people to understand, even in 2024, and your book is, it makes this point so beautifully, well, tragically and beautifully at the same time. The audience needs to know this happens all the time today, not so much in Fulton County or Birmingham or Charlotte, but in small towns throughout the South. Today, prosecutors are striking jurors for no other reason than their race, because they want all white juries to convict wrongly accused black people. And that's happening today in America, and it's happening everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, and sometimes in places where there are significant African-American populations, in places like 20-30%, you can still wind up with all white juries for a variety of reasons, and not the least of which is the peremptory challenge part of it. So if, let's say you get 8 or 10 peremptory strikes, you know, you have a lower return rate. So one of the structural things happens is, you know, different populations return the jury summons at different rates. And there are lots of reasons why, you know, African-Americans generally return summons and show up for court at a lower rate, and poverty and other things, and
sure,
difficulty changing work obligations and right. So forth, childcare. I mean, it's very complicated, but yeah. So you see what you describe, even in these places, in these counties where you have a significant African-American population, still all white juries.
And I had one more question about that. I think you're the right person to answer. So I have a close friend whose daughter is currently working for the Federal Public Defender's Office in Portland. And I am very, very familiar with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Atlanta, federal public. And my understanding is they get paid the same as U.S. attorneys. And my understanding, and I know the Atlanta office has the highest caliber lawyers you could find. I mean, these are people totally committed, smart, public, just really good lawyers. And that's true in Portland as well. At the state level, and Georgia has been an epicenter for this, as you write in this book, in indigent defense and public defender offices are so underfunded. And everyone knows this, the resources are so lacking. Why can't, for example, the state of Georgia do what the U.S. government did and have real public defenders? I'm not maligning the actual public defenders. They work really hard and do the best they can. But they're overworked with no money. But the feds have figured this out. Because my understanding is the federal public defenders do a great job. And that's what I've seen in my own two eyes. Why can't this work on the state level, Robert? It would make the need for Stephen Bright so much less if we had that system at the state level.
I mean, I agree with you. And I think most people who study the problems with indigent defense systems across the country have reached that conclusion that, you know, in a sense, we need to have a revival of the public defender movement. I mean, there's a
yes.
period in American history where professionalization the norms and the push for that coincided with, you know, rising belief in rights, especially after World War II. And a lot of places that, you know, had the kind of legal services delivery system, which is very patchwork, like in Georgia until more recently, you know, really looked hard at this question and said, the only way we can do this is if we truly move to a system where there's a greater norm of equalization of resources on both sides, that we can never even approach, you know, anywhere close to the ideal of, you know, Gideon versus Wainwright, where the poor person, you know, isn't just going to get railroaded, but they right. have, you know, someone standing next to them, you know, who knows something about the law, is going to fight for them as vigorously as the prosecution wants to put them in jail or kill them.
Right.
And, right. You know, the only way to do that is to think hard about how you do that. So, you know, I mean, I talk a little bit about, you know, Georgia's push all these years later towards the first statewide public defender system. And, you know, they're only able to do that in what, 2003, in a kind of piecemeal
right.
way.
And by the way, Emmett Bondurant, who we talked about earlier, was a big piece of that, by the way. But go ahead.
Huge. Yeah. He played yeah. a huge role in pushing the bar to really be out front alongside the social activists like Bright.
But it hasn't really worked, Robert, has it? I mean,
well, I think I would say yes and no. And the biggest piece is the piece that you and I are focusing on, which is the funding.
Yes.
And you know, in order to get the framework of it, they had to put off the funding question until the next session. And they kind of jerry-rigged the funding part. So that was obviously a compromise choice. But don't forget, they also got the political framework in a very red state at a time when the governor was Republican.
Right.
So you know, a huge commitment even at that level. But the funding thing remained an issue and remains an issue. And when I say they jerry-rigged it, what I mean is they decided that most of the statewide indigent defense pot of money would come from like raising fees and fines, rather than coming out of the you know the General Assembly's budget. Interestingly enough, there were times where that bucket was pretty big. Now each county would have to you know take care of the gap, of course,
Right.
between what the state could offer and the county's own needs. Sometimes that was pretty big, but you know there were times when, including pretty recently, where the state would just raid that bucket that was supposedly set aside for indigent defense. So there's got to be a way to get to a system where the funding is more reliable. It's clearly coming from state resources, and it can't be raided in the way that it has been by, you know, the governor's underlings and so forth.
What was your re We're skipping topic to topic here, but that's okay. It's fun. How much of a heart palpitation did you get? I had a big one when Thomas and Gorsuch said that they should revisit. So in a concurring opinion somewhere, in some case, Thomas and Gorsuch both said the court should reconsider Gideon versus Wainwright, which to my I am not a crim pro, Robert, I am not a crim pro person. I don't I'm not an expert on the Fourth through Eighth Amendments, but one thing I do know is that Gideon is one of the great cases in American history. It stands for the principle that everybody in America gets a lawyer if you're charged with a serious crime, whether you can afford one or not. I can't imagine a free democratic country that doesn't have a rule like that, yet Thomas and Gorsuch want to reconsider it. How sad were you when you read that?
Well, you know, yes, sad. On the other hand, not too surprised.
Yeah.
You know, for Thomas, I think it grows out of you know his longtime beef with you know substantive rights coming out of the Due Process Clause, and of course, you know, Gideon is part of that, and also. You know, for Gorsuch, and there's a little bit of this in one of the oral arguments in the cases that Bright argues. I think it's the fourth case that he argues, McWilliams versus Dunn, which raises the question of what we owe people who might be intellectually disabled who are
Right.
facing, you know, a murder charge. And
How
if
about
there's
this?
evidence of
Don't how
that,
about this? Don't kill them. If they're intellectually
how about don't
disabled,
kill
how about
them?
this?
So
Don't kill
we at least have that as an aspiration now, right? And
Right.
the difficulty is how to identify where that
I
line
know.
is.
I know.
But the question of the expert, because a lot of lawyers don't know how to get the evidence that might persuade a judge or a jury that their client really is impaired enough that they're deserving of mercy. The reason why it's connected to what you raised is this, is that, you know, Gorsuch looks at things like the Due Process Clause and would like to roll that back to purely a procedural thing. And an
Well,
originalist thing, which might be, you know, something like, will look something like this. What you're entitled to in terms of a lawyer or an expert would be, you know, what could have been understood in 1868. Which would mean that we would have to roll back a whole bunch of cases like, you know, this case, Aki versus Oklahoma and so forth.
I would have thought that even the most conservative people think, yeah, if you're charged with a serious crime and you can't afford a lawyer and you're really indigent, the state should provide one. That's just to be fair. It's amazing to me that both Gorsuch and Thomas, I don't think they're going to get 5 votes to do this, because I think Gideon is viewed as a symbol of
But
America.
you raise a really interesting question though, because like where's that coming from? I mean, I just gave you an answer that's kind of jurisprudential, but we all know that it's always more than that.
Yes.
And so I think that there's another thing going on here too, which is, you know, you're right. If you're a kind of institutional conservative, or you're one who believes in substantive notion of dignity, you know, you might care about how proceedings are and how people who are vulnerable are treated by the criminal justice system. But if you think a lot of these things, like the right to counsel or right to an expert, are like something like unfunded mandates.
Yes.
So coming out of the Reagan Revolution, like conservatives kind of radicalized or you know, awakening to their politics during that period, look around the world and see a lot of things that liberals did, and see everything as an unfunded mandate. Then Gideon versus Wainwright is one of those as well, because it imposes an obligation on all these jurisdictions to actually put money to something like
right.
giving people lawyers.
And let me just also say, you don't have to react to this if you don't want to. You're free to, but you don't have to. As I wrote on Dorf on Law, that we're taping this on a Tuesday. This piece came out last week. To me, it's I don't know about Gorsuch. I don't really know what motivates Gorsuch. He's very mysterious to me. The Western guy who grew up in Bethesda private school with Kavanaugh, you know. But as far as Thomas goes, you don't have to own this. This is on me, not you. To me, it's just his continuing war on people of color. That's what he's been warring with people. He has tried to hurt people of color for 35 years. That's his job in life. That's how he views his mission, I think. It's why he just hired a law clerk who said she hates all black people. This is just more, obviously, this is going to, if he had his way in criminal procedure, people of color would be hurt tremendously in our system. And that's just another one of his chapters of hurting people of color. You don't, if you want to react, you can, but you don't have to react to that if you don't want to.
I do want to react to that. I mean,
okay.
You know, it could be that's right, but you know, I sort of lean towards the sort of Corey Robin reading.
Yeah, I don't, but go ahead.
I know. And let me just offer a version of that, which is I think that, you know, when Thomas was younger, he was attracted to ideas of black nationalism. And because there's this sort of, you know, the tradition of black uplift, really focuses on the individual and really is skeptical of white liberals, because, you know, the idea is white liberals always want something from you, right? And then, you know, he goes into elite institution like Yale Law School eventually and becomes really alienated from that place and feels like, you know, he's been tokenized and so forth. And, you know, so I think that there is a kind of fairly consistent and increasingly stronger thread to his politics and then his jurisprudence where, you know, it's kind of like, it's the closest thing would be like the Fountainhead, because I know he's invoked that.
But, you know, but Robert,
it's the individual against everything.
I do want to talk about this because he's been in the news so much and he's been a big part of my life, sadly, for the last few years. You're just describing how he got to the point where he's hurting people of color. My point is that what I wrote on last week was this Corey's book, there's other things. I don't care what the theory is. I don't care why. His jurisprudence is as bad for people of color as any justice in American history, in my view. Even the ones who at the time were Justice Taney, whoever. I don't want to get sidelined on that, but I think was describe.
If you're a consequentialist, I 100% agree with this because, I mean, it was, and it's not even a recent thing. There was a professor at UGA who, you know, there was all that uproar when Justice Thomas was asked to give a speech. And I'm trying to remember who the professor was, but I remember vividly.
Well, the dean of Georgia had to leave. Have to leave. The dean of Georgia resigned because the faculty were such babies over that issue. I mean, look, no one hates Thomas more than I do, but if he wants to come to your law school, let him come to your law school. The Supreme Court
I'm not really for deplatforming people, but there was this professor who had even then listed all the cases and all the votes that Justice Thomas back then had signed on to and argued that his jurisprudence already had the greatest negative human rights effect of any job.
I think that's right. I think that's right. When I gave a talk on Saturday to 500 trial lawyers, which was kind of fun, but because they were not con law people. But the biggest laugh of my talk was when we were in a talk about originalism, and I said even Scalia said, and I quote, "I'm an originalist, but I'm not a nut," referring to Justice Thomas, and the whole room cracked up. But it's true. Anyway, let's get back to Stephen Breyer and the death penalty. I do want to ask you this about the death penalty, because I don't think this is necessarily Stephen's passion so much. Arguing and winning cases is his passion. I think my audience would really appreciate, if you've done this, I don't know if you have. I assume you think the death penalty is not only wrong, which I do, but unconstitutional, which I'm not sure about because of my views on judicial review. Do you think the death penalty is unconstitutional?
So that's a complicated question. I mean, I'll answer in a personal way, which was, you know, back to my original journey at the beginning, I was talking about, I went from, you know, having to argue in favor of capital punishment in terms of retributivism, eye for an eye, and being comfortable with that as a young man growing up in the Reagan years, to questioning it. But I have a complicated view about this, and it may be that comes across in the book. Maybe it doesn't. I try to put Bright in the best light I can.
Yeah, you don't come through this book. The book is about him. You do a great job on that. You do a great job.
I mean, the one thing I would own is, I think personally, I've always been more of a person who believes that things ought to be resolved in the realm of politics as much as possible. I'm more of a popular constitutionalist, which means that I'm always skeptical when elites try to force their presentations of the Constitution or morality. So I've never bought Dworkin's approach.
Me neither. We agree on
this. Yeah, I mean, yes. You know, and the system I don't think is ultimately set up for that. It's set up to have a lot to be contestable. And so how does that carry over to the death penalty? I mean, I do think that there are questions of human dignity and questions of racial equality, geographic disparities that come up over and over, resource inequality, poverty, all of those things are documented over and over and over. And so if I were a policymaker, I would have no trouble doing what some GOP legislators in Utah are trying to do, which is to abolish the death penalty in Utah legislatively. I do have more qualms with very, very broad rulings like the court had done and tried to do in Furman, and then abolishing it across the country and then having to back away from that. I mean, I give them points for kind of acknowledging that they probably went too far and that they needed to take into account what voters actually think. And I'm much happier in some ways with the way things have developed, which is that the kinds of arguments that Bright and others have made about the actual enforcement of the death penalty, that they're hard to defend. And eventually to convince people to back away from it. I'm much happier with that having played out, where at this moment, you know, we've got, including Virginia, which is the most striking thing. Virginia is credited with, you know, possibly killing the first person in the colonies, and has killed, you know, so many people over the years, recently abolished the death penalty. And they did that legislatively.
Right. So we agree on that 100%, probably a lot of other things. Let me ask you this about that then. My view is this, and part of this is because I clerked in the Northern District of Georgia back a million billion years ago when the McCleskey case was in the Northern District of Georgia. You write about the McCleskey case in your book. I'm going to ask you about it in a second. But before we get to the McCleskey case, there is no question in my mind that in this country the death penalty is being imposed in a racially discriminatory manner. There's just no question in my mind. So in that sense, I would not mind judges saying, until this is changed, we can't have the death penalty anymore. Because it's, and if you think about it, I guess, in a racist society, of course the death penalty is going to be imposed in a racist way. We can live with that with murder, arson, robbery, whatever. With the death penalty, I'm not sure. So I'm with you. I don't think the court should, I think it's a hard argument to make that it's unconstitutional in some kind of originalist, textualist, rule of law type of decision. But I think we could say, the way it's being imposed in this country has unconstitutional implications, and until that changes, it should go away. Do you agree with that?
You know, what you just described is pretty close to something I wrote in my last book, Practical Quality. That's the first time I sort of thought hard about the McCleskey case. And one of the things I argued in there is that there was a road not taken in that litigation. And
okay, before we get, okay. What, or,
yeah, go ahead.
Let me cut you off there. What was the holding? So to my mind, let me just give you my my bird's eye view of that case. I was with law clerks having lunch every day who were working on that case. These were not liberal people, and they were not liberal. And they were like, oh my God, this is terrible. The data is horrific. The race of the victim is crucial. All kinds of other basic, and so the case goes to the Supreme Court on the issue of, is the death penalty being imposed in a racially discriminatory manner? You take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, McCleskey was, you know, end up being a 5-4 decision, where the court really didn't have anything to negative to say about the study, the Baldus study, which found all these disparities. But then, you know, through Justice Powell's decision, for the court, found ways to insulate institutionally the role of the prosecutor, the role of juries, and make it, the way I talk about it, is make it nearly impossible to bring structural inequality claims against the criminal justice system. So you know, a lot of people point to that decision as being incredibly demoralizing. I think I quote Brian Stevens.
It was for me. It was for me, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's hard to teach that case, you know, without feeling that it was terrible. But going back to your earlier point, is that the first time I wrote about McCleskey was in the last book I wrote, Practical Equality, and I suggested that maybe the court should have done a narrower thing rather than doing the terrible thing they did in McCleskey, which is to insulate the entire criminal justice system. A narrower ground would have been, if the equality ground was too broad, a fairness ground. So it would have been a due process violation. And it would have said, at the time, looking around, there were almost no policy. There were certainly no policies statewide. But there were, even looking at Fulton County, like there were no policies being used to help guide prosecutorial discretion as to, you know, to determine which kind of cases they were going to seek the death penalty in, and that most likely was leading to the greatest amount of inequality or disparity, or what we call here lack of fairness. And if the court had done that,
I agree.
Then at least the dialogue would have continued, and then maybe you could have had some additional data about whether having a more a uniform process like we have at the federal level. So at the federal level, I don't know if you know this, but some of your listeners might not, but like no U.S. attorney can seek the death penalty without approval from Maine Justice. And at Maine Justice, they do proportionality review in advance, meaning they look at all the other cases where DOJ has sought the death penalty. And if some U.S. attorney wants to seek the death penalty, but it's what the facts aren't right, it's an outlier, they'll say no. That's one way to reduce the disparities.
Right. And I want to emphasize the amount of money and time and effort that went into that report you're referring to that the Supreme Court basically ignored. I mean, and that was the most demoralizing part, because I'm not saying that that case had to come out a certain way or another way, but that report was strong. And that report showed with incredible clarity how badly the death penalty is implemented in a racially discriminatory manner, and the court was basically like, we don't care. And that was extremely disappointing, I have to say.
Absolutely. I mean, I get into this a little bit in the book. I have written a kind of follow-up article, which if people are interested in McCleskey, where I go a little bit more deeply into the Southern Center for Human Rights activities in the wake of McCleskey. And I note that you know, Powell's trying to shut down a lot of these structural racism claims and make life more orderly for judges, but that there's a little bit of an ironic effect because, of course, Supreme Court can't control what the rest of us do when we want to thumb their nose at them.
Thank God,
if you're a lawyer and you think that what they've done is outrageous, then there are things that can be done. And what these lawyers did was to basically double down on equality, I say, and they started more aggressively going after judges and prosecutors for either being intentionally racist or being complicit in manufacturing all white juries, looking the other way when some of this stuff is happening. And also, you know, if Powell wanted no more empirical evidence, well, he didn't get that because in at least some of their cases, they found ways to show that entire prosecutor's offices were essentially bouncing every black person off their capital cases. And they put those right in the record. And in a case called Horton versus Zant, they finally got the 11th Circuit to agree that's a huge violation. So,
and that's a Steve Bright case.
And that's a 100% a Steve Bright case. Yeah. He did that with a cooperating attorney and a whole bunch of interns.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Robert, we are almost out of time. So if you don't, and so I want to repeat the name of the book, Demand the Impossible, One Lawyer's Pursuit of Equal Justice for All. Stephen Bright's life has in fact been devoted to equal justice for all. And he's a public figure people should know about. So people should read this book. I also want to mention that you're a public figure people should know about. Your pursuit of justice, I think, in your writings is really, I'm moved by it and inspired by it. So my last question for you is, and I didn't tell you this was coming, so you don't have to answer it. You strike me as someone in your writing, and this is the first time you and I have actually met face-to-face, I think, although we know each other from other things pretty well. Robert, your work has a undertone of optimism to it that I can't reproduce. I probably don't want to reproduce it, but your work has an undertone of the world's going to get better. We can't stop working to make the world better. And I don't know where you get that from. I wish I had it because I look around me. My Twitter persona is Dr. Doom and Gloom, which I'm not proud of, but it's what it is. My life, which surrounds around the Supreme Court mostly, is not an optimistic life, either now or any time in the last 30 years. How do you keep kind of – I know this is a personal question, but how do you keep this undertone of optimism? I mean, you're a realist. You see what's going on in the world, but you have this undertone of things can get better. Where does that come from, and can you share it with me? Because I don't have it.
That's a deep question. I'm glad you asked it, though. I think where does it come from? I'm not sure where it comes from. I mean, one possible source where it comes from is I do think that I feel a kind of an obligation. I mean, I've been very fortunate in my life. I was not born in the United States. I was born in Taiwan, brought over as a kid. And, you know, I have been able to do things that were unimaginable, you know, to be teaching at BU, teaching con law, you know,
right. Given
my background, you know.
It is a gift, isn't it?
And to be able to write books and teach students, many of whom want to make the world better. Mm-hmm. So I try to remind myself of that. And I think that I sort of feel an obligation, I guess, to my children and to my students that I should wring as much as I can out of the past achievements of people who also faced kind of arduous circumstances and beat the odds to do something great for humanity. And so I guess that's what sort of has turned me more into a legal historian and constitutional historian over time. I feel most comfortable writing in that register. Mm-hmm. And I try to do that with Bright, is that, man, he was able to do some stuff in court that was really hard to do. Now, maybe other people could have done it too, but you first have to think that you're capable of it. And he did it as things got harder. So as the court was becoming more conservative, more hostile to the rights of criminal defendants, as it was becoming more Republican and so on, right? As Congress got in on the act and made it harder to give relief, right? When there was a constitutional violation of some sort. So I guess that's what keeps me going. And that's my sense of obligation. Why write? It also is intellectually interesting to me, because I feel like it's the only way out. is to kind of mine the past to see what we can learn about.
I'm glad you feel that way, because I feel like we have to burn it all down and start over, which I know we're not going to do, and it's not the right answer. Everybody really listening to this should be reading you. You do all kinds of things in the social space and public media all the time. Robert Tsai is a professor at Boston University. This book about Stephen Bright is excellent and inspiring. All of your books are inspiring. And I really strongly recommend people read your work. And really, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Eric. It was a pleasure.